the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Buddy, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one, but three chat rooms thus far, maybe more sooner or later. But nonetheless, today I want to talk about the mechanics of magnetism mechanics. There's a couple videos that I posted over there. One of which isn't necessarily related directly to magnetism, but it does have some magnetism involved. Anyway, Sky Collection is probably one of my favorite YouTube channels out there, and he speaks Spanish, and I don't really speak Spanish too well. Maybe I'll have to get Raymond sometime to sit in on some of these videos so I can actually listen to what he's saying, but all I have to do is watch his videos, and I can understand what he's doing in these videos. See, he does all kinds of different types of pancake coil style motors and magnetic, I want to say magnetic levitation, which essentially that's what it is with some of the bearings that he does, that he gets really impressive pulse motor and high RPM style things going on. The anomalies when he's running these little homemade coils and generator systems and motors is pretty impressive. And so if you have an opportunity to go over there and subscribe to Sky Collection, if you're interested in coils and magnetism and electric motors, he's one to keep an eye on, because as far as I'm concerned, if there's a person out there that's actually going to build an over-unity device, he's going to be the first one to do it. And the reason I say that is because he tries all different types of things, and I think he understands how the magnetic fields actually work, to the extent where it's like a gear in a machine. If you got, like, let's just start off with just your regular magnet. A magnet that has a static field, so to speak. Basically, when the flux lines stretch out from that magnet, they're there. They're stationary, at least to the visible eye. You can't necessarily see. I mean, I'm saying to people that I believe that there's a whole lot more going on in that permanent magnet than people realize, that there's actually flow going on there. It's not just a stationary field that's occurring. But nonetheless, if you understand how that field is stretched out from that magnet, then you can turn around and you can utilize the forces out there, because we know that the positive, two positive fields will repel each other, and two opposite fields will attract each other. And so with that said, if you put one magnet next to the other, you'll get some sort of reaction depending on what type of polarity, whether it's the North Pole or the South Pole. And so, when I'm trying to explain this, I'm going to skip all the high-tech terminology and just try to put it in the perspective of how mechanically, how this is actually occurring. So, one of the things that I used to do back whenever I started building little mini generators and running my YouTube channel to show people some things that I figured out, was that I figured out that, you know, with Lenz law and eddy currents, you get some weird things going on in the generators. And if you have the magnets surrounding your rotor, that every time you put that under a load, Lenz law kicks in, and suddenly you have this second field, because the electrons are flowing back into the same generator you're actually trying to pull the energy from. Now, when it comes down to generating systems and all the experiments that the alternative energy community's been working on, what they're trying to be able to accomplish is to figure out how to get more energy out for least amount of work in. And so they're trying all different types of configurations, all different types of coil systems, and ways to pulse the generator heads and stuff like that. And so they're trying to be able to produce a standard electricity like you would be using, on your computer right now, or even a light bulb, or anything that you run, any standard appliance that you run requires a lot of current flow to get these things to function properly. And so the trick about it is that, when you put your generator under load, immediately Lenz law takes effect, and it begins to act like a secondary braking system. The more power that you try to draw off of that generator, the stronger that second field becomes and the harder that that generator actually has to work. And so that's one of the reasons why people say that over unity is not possible and zero point energy or whatever is not possible because you have all these losses. There's so many different things such as friction and heat losses, and you can go on and on about all the different ways that you lose energy trying to transfer energy from this generator that you're trying to pull the energy off of to run your appliances. And so what I figured out back in the day was that by using a flywheel type of system to where essentially your magnets were only grazing the side of the coil, the sides or the tops of the coil, as long as those magnetic flux lines could pass through enough of that coil wire that you would be able to run this thing without causing that lens effect to be strong enough to literally bog down the rotor. And so what that meant was that when I put it under load, I don't have near the amount of back EMF or the lens effect that I would have had if had those magnets been surrounding the rotor or vice versa. And so instead of that brake being so strong, it was basically like a slipping clutch on an automobile, you know. It still got enough friction to turn the other end of the clutch plate, but it doesn't have enough to literally lock into place and stop it. So using the flywheel where it's pretty much just hovering above the magnetic field, or vice versa, the magnetic field hovering above the flywheel, it reduced the lens effect. And so what you see in this video that Sky Collection has done with the pancake coils was that he's actually using that same type of effect, and you can actually see in the video he'll turn this thing sideways and you can see where the light that he's using on the other side is not coming on when it's straight up and down. So that shows you that there is a mechanical line of flux thing going on there where it's not hitting enough. The flux lines aren't hitting enough of those coils in order to make that light come on. But then when he turns it sideways, then you can see where the magnetic flux lines were actually coming around and energizing that coil, which then in turn turned the light bulb on. And so you can actually get a physical, you know, idea of where those flux lines are by using that magnet, using those coils the way that he did. And also, as you see in the same video, he has the coils not directly underneath the rotor that he's using. He has it off to the side. So as these coils are pulsing and those fields are expanding and collapsing rapidly, it's causing the rotor to be able to turn. And then you can hear the RPMs just continue to rise as he's pulsing this thing. And it gets higher and higher to the point where, you know, the spin of the rotor is like a high-pitched squeal going on. So that's pretty impressive RPMs that he's getting out of that. And then he also shows that after he takes the coil, the same coil system that he's using to pulse it, and puts it underneath the rotor, then you can actually see the lens effect occur. You can hear it audibly and you can see it visibly that the rotor actually starts to slow down because now it's being wrapped around by this field and it's trying to energize itself into a second field, if you understand what I'm saying. And the same thing, if you look at this mechanically, you can also see this in like a Tesla coil situation. Like when I'm using a 20,000 volt oil burner igniter to pulse some coils, that field that is going on in there, when it's left alone, it will stretch out, it will energize all these coils. But that field will also follow another field, because anytime you put two magnetic fields within general vicinity of each other, they will try to merge with each other and become one. So if I take my hand on my lab table where I've got this, basically it's a plasma globe up there, and I put my hand in the general vicinity, you can actually hear a difference in the ringing of the coils. Plus you can see that the energy, the magnetic field, is actually trying to combine with my hand. You can see that a visible change as the energy follows from all the coils into the direction of where I'm actually placing my hand. And so if you can understand what's going on there, and you understand in this video that Sky Collection is doing, you can actually see where the best place to position your coils are. With regular magnet paper, you can put a piece of magnet paper over the top of any magnet, and you can literally see the lines of flux, right? Now, the way that we use the copper coils and stuff like that to, shake loose the electrons to get the electron flow inside there, you want the maximum amount of flux line crossing through those coils to, basically get the electrical flow going. But at the same sense, you don't want the flux lines to be centered in that coil system, because now you have two magnetic fields that are trying to interact with each other. When those two fields, you've got the first field that you're generating by pushing your voltage in and producing the first magnetic field, and then you got the lens effect, which is the second magnetic field that's actually being produced as the energy is trying to balance itself back out, or the electron flow going back in the opposite direction. Those two fields want to combine. Even though one is coming one way and the other is coming that way, anytime you put two magnetic fields in general vicinity of each other, you're going to get this reaction. And you can see this perfectly by taking just two rare earth magnets and setting them down on the table and scooting one of them close to each other. Instantaneously, those two fields will align themselves, and then those two magnets will slam together. So, understanding how those magnetic flux lines, the directions of where they're at on that magnet, will tell you the best path in order to put those magnetic flux lines across your coils in order to get the electron flow going, which is basically the electricity that we use. Now, this particular design that Sky Collection is doing, He's done many, his craftsmanship's amazing, but he's done many videos. This one here in particular I really like, because it basically, when you're looking at this video, if you look at it in a mechanical sense, he's figured out the perfect place to put those coils. Using that magnetic field as a gear, as opposed to, I'm kind of thinking like drum brakes on a car, it's not surrounding it, and so you're not going to have that strong effect. All it's doing is allowing that field, when it expands and collapses, to graze the coil that he's energizing, which means that it is going to, at the very least, lessen the effect and not make it where any load that he puts on her, including if you look on watching a video and you see the portion where he puts the other coil on there, that the light comes on. The moment that light comes on, those two fields want to combine. They want to shift over. They want to become one field, and it's not allowing it to do that. So you can still hear the high RPMs of the rotor itself, because it's not causing that drag that would normally occur anytime you put these two fields together. You can actually run some tests if you have some transformers and try exactly what it is that I'm saying. If you're doing any kind of, I don't know where that static's coming from. I'm about to find that. Let me try something here. Nope, that ain't it. Anyway.
I don't hear any static over here. Sorry.
Oh. If you got a couple transformers and you have a couple voltmeters and you run these two transformers with a voltmeter on there and you actually measure the voltage, if you put anything like a permanent magnet in that field, you'll notice an instant change in the voltage on there. If you get either one of these transformers close enough to each other where that magnetic field, the flux lines can come in contact with each other, you'll notice an instant change on that voltmeter, because those fields want to combine and become one. Don't ask me how, because like science says, it's basically magic. They don't understand gravity, you know. They theorize what gravity is, and some people believe that gravity is actually a form of magnetism. Whatever the case may be, if you're trying to build a generator system and you want to not allow these two fields to invoke the lens effect, then you got to learn where to put these things so that they're not trying to grab each other, so to speak. So this video that he put up there was pretty amazing. He also put a second video up there where he was showing an example of eddy currents. And he shows where there's an aluminum rotor that he made, like the copper one that he did. And he shows you that he puts a magnet on it, shows you that it's not magnetic. And then he's able to use the eddy currents to actually spin the second the aluminum rotor with it. So if you're interested, look into what lens effect's all about, lens law, and look into eddy currents, what they're all about. Eddy currents, one of the things that you can do, you can actually take a copper tube and you can slide a magnet down there, and you'll note that the magnetic field interacts with the copper and the magnet will fall slowly through the copper tube. And because it's actually interacting with the electrons inside there, it's producing a field that's trying to act as a brake. And that's a perfect example of what's going on when you try to pull a load off of a generator that you're trying to use to run your lights or any appliances and stuff like that. You're actually creating a second field that it's basically allowing a path for that electron flow to go right back into the same generator. And think about this for a second. To make an electromagnet, you wrap some copper wire or whatever around the piece of steel, and then you will apply a current to that copper wire. And so that would produce a field. Well, now when that electron flow is coming out of your generator, you're essentially doing the same exact thing as you did in the electromagnet, and you're producing a field. So when you're putting energy to the coil, you're producing a field. When you're drawing energy off the coil, you're producing a field. And those two fields want to combine with each other and interact and act like a brake until that field all balances itself out. When you keep on putting, try it sometime, get you a little generator and put a whole bunch of lights on multiple different switches. Turn the first one on, watch it bog down, and keep turning them on. The larger that field is, the more it's capable of those electrons to be able to flow back into that generator. You'll get to a point where that generator will literally stop itself. It's an electromagnetic brake that you just created. That's why you have all your generators out there. Say you have like a normal wattage, and then you got a peak maximum that you can actually go on there to drain energy off of that before that generator will fail is because it can only withstand so much before it basically the brakes are completely on. It'd be like riding down the road with your brakes on. Eventually, you know, something's got to give. Anyway, if you look at a magnetic field like a cog or a gear in a machine, and you want to be able to utilize that surface area, which would be the flux lines, these experiments that Ludic Science is doing, not Ludic Science, that's the one that's in the second video down there. He's the one that did the capacitor deal. But Sky Collection, these are the experiments that he's doing, utilizing those pancake coils and building things like pulse motors and magnetic bearing type deals and getting amazing results because he understands how those flux lines, the direction of them and so on, are going. And so when these people are out there doing these magnet motors, where they're trying to get these motors to repel off of each other, and then they get this cogging effect where when the magnet goes past one magnet, it is drawn back because of the opposites poles now being facing each other. What they should be trying to figure out is how to utilize that same force, but then adding in some gears that will never allow those magnets to align. As long as those magnets can never align with each other to the point where now the opposites are facing each other, then you should be able to keep a constant forward motion by using these magnetic flux lines and the poles of the magnets as a gear. You understand what I'm saying, Raymond? Is it making any sense to you?
You're making more daggone sense than I ever thought. You really are. I mean, think about this. I mean, we're talking about the slingshot effect.
Yep, we want those flux lines to do some work, and right. we know that the opposites will attract and the positive will repel, and that right. these two magnetic fields are going to try to balance themselves out. That's what nature does. Nature always puts itself back in balance when you do wait. Something.
Wait a minute. Thomas and I have discussed several times exactly what you're talking about, and on the two-phase oscillator.
Yeah.
We're using a heavy weight falling toward the earth. How does it fall? Why does it fall? Because it's a heavy weight. It has a lot of density.
Yep.
For the earth has a lot of density, so this heavy weight is falling. Now, all of a sudden, it's coming into contact with, this heavy weight has a magnet on it. Now, all of a sudden, it comes down to a certain point, and at that point, at that instant, it's reached its maximum density of magnetic flux. Now, if you change the flux, what's happened here?
Well, one thing I can see that you could do with that is that you can use the two positive fields as a spring. See, we talked about using the magnetic field as a gear, but you can also use the magnetic field as a spring.
And Scott Brown, Muddy Muddy Mudman, said the same thing.
Yeah.
Use the spring. Okay? So all of a sudden you're at bottom dead center. Now, if the two objects touch, if they touch, you got a problem.
Well, yeah, then that means that you'd have to reduce whatever weight force is coming down.
Okay,
but if you're not trying to overcome that force of that magnetic spring, and the spring, you get it right perfect where maybe just like a hair before touching that
hair, the full, that's it, right there.
Yeah.
At that moment. You neutralize it, but it's a split second. I mean, we're talking about 100,000th of a second. At that moment, you neutralize. Then you energize.
Yep.
I mean, you just said it several times. The gearing must be absolutely correct. At one point, they're pulling. You have a negative and a positive, and they're pulling together. And all of a sudden, you need to neutralize.
Yes, and we use, in mechanics, we use a gearing and chain drive mechanisms to literally, whenever, like, say, the camshaft or as it's turning around, you want the timing to be perfect on there for your ignition on your distributor, however you're, you know, firing your deal. So the gear will only allow it to fire when it gets to a certain point. You see what I'm saying?
Exactly. It's called timing.
Yeah. And the same thing could be done utilizing magnetics, that you could use where you know the positive and negative are. You got a gear that will never allow these two positives and negatives to face each other.
Right. So the positive and negative pull together.
Yeah.
At one point, you need to neutralize, totally neutralize, to where there is nothing. There is no pull, there is no push. And at that point, they just pass. And then once it passes, then that's when you positive both, negative both. It doesn't matter. At that point, they're going to push.
Well, see, one.
That's the whole damn secret. The whole secret, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
From French.
The whole thing that. The reason Sky Collection is literally showing you how to find the timing and how to use a magnetic field as gear mechanically. You can see what's going on, especially whenever he takes the coil and he sticks it right up underneath the doggone thing. You can literally see and hear as the RPMs drop down drastically, because now that rotor is actually surrounded by that magnetic flux lines, and it's trying to balance itself out, which is producing the lens effect, the drag that we all, you know, try to get around.
Wait a minute. Two pieces of steel will not attract or repel each other. Right?
No, not unless one of them is, magnetized.
I didn't say that. I said... Just, two pieces of steel.
Yeah, just under normal circumstances, no, they won't.
No. So, at one point, one of them is a magnet. Period. It's attracting itself to a piece of steel. At the other moment, at the precise moment, the timing, either one is a magnet. Right?
Yeah, so...
So they're going to pass each other. Now, once it's passed, it doesn't matter if it's a microsecond or a microinch or a micromillimeter. It doesn't matter. Once it passes, and all of a sudden they both become the same, then they're going to rebel.
What you just said was brilliant, because you can literally, depending on which direction of polarity you put your positive and your negative on, like a electromagnet, when these two are under normal circumstances, neither one of them's energized.
But exactly.
When you get it to where you want it to repel, all you have to do is either flip the polarity or make them to the same polarity, so that you have that repel force when you want it. And so using, you know, like a timing system, maybe reed switches or whatever, you can actually tell that coil when to energize, and then the rest of the time it's non-magnetic. So even if one of them's magnetized and the other one's not, then you'll get an attraction. And if neither one of them is energized at the same time, you won't get nothing. It'll be able to spin right on by.
Question. If you take two copper coils, and you rotate one and the other one is sitting still, do you get a lens law effect? If a copper coil passes a copper coil, do you get a lens law effect?
If you, if there's a magnetic field present, if, like...
No, I didn't say that. I said, alright, wait a minute. I'm going to say something really stupid, okay? All rose bushes have thorns. This bush has thorns. Therefore, it is a rose bush, correct? Or yes or no? True or false?
I don't know. I see a lot of thorn bushes around my neighborhood.
but do they have roses on them?
Nope.
Okay. I did not say all bushes with thorns are roses. I said all rose bushes have thorns.
Yep.
Now, all of a sudden, I'm asking you a question. If you pass two copper coils by each other, do you get a lens law effect?
No.
Okay. Now, if you pass two pieces of steel by each other, do you get lens law? No.
No, not until up until the point where you energize that coil and there's magnetic flux involved.
Now you're talking. Not until you put a thorn on the bush.
So, basically, the way that they're building electric motors is really kind of, I don't know, in my view, ridiculous, because they know about lens effect. And so, in order to reduce that effect to the extent where you could actually get a really impressive percentage of, efficiency, is what a word I'm trying to find. Because once you energize that generator head, and you then introduce a load, now you're sending the same energy that you took off of the generator right back into the same thing, which is going to grab anything that's made out of metal right up. And you don't even have to have any metal in an electric motor in order to produce a magnetic field. It's just they use...
Right.
Huh?
Right.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I've told you 1,000 times. You're 117.5% correct.
You can actually take and test this theory out by taking two different, just wind up a couple turns of any copper wire and just kind of dangle them there on something and put the fields, put like a little 9-volt battery would be just fine. Put a 9-volt battery to each one of the coils. First put one, put them both the same positive and the same negative, and then watch the reaction that you'll get. You'll see they'll push each other away, and then you do the opposite. You flip one around on the opposite side, and you'll see that they'll attract each other. So now you got a general idea of where those flux lines and where the repulsion and the attraction is going on. You see what I'm saying? Anytime you have those two fields within general vicinity of each other, they're going to react that way. And once the magnetic field itself finally reaches its maximum, that's how far apart those two coils are going to be. And if you have them basically on the attraction mode where they're opposites, then those two fields will come together and there will be actually a maximum of how strong that magnetic field is as well. No matter what you do, pushing them apart or whatever, the magnetic field is going to literally combine into one magnetic field. Anytime these magnetic fields come within general vicinity of each other, they will combine and become one. And that's how I believe that when electrons are being energized, so to speak, in a copper wire, that the more electrons that you have energized, the stronger that magnetic field becomes. Therefore, we have multiple turns for, you know, our transformers or our electric motors or whatever, because as those flux lines are passing through there, it's able to get more surface area on that copper wire and shake loose that 29th electron and get it to interact with all the rest of them. Even if those electrons aren't really moving and they're just kind of rocking back and forth and interacting with each other, those magnetic fields are combining every time they do it for a stronger field until it's one solid field. What do you think? I think I lost Raymond. Anyway, so until Raymond jumps back in there, go look at these two videos that Sky Collection's done, and you can see it's really impressive the type of RPMs that he's getting off of these two setups that he's got.
You did not lose me. I was trying to keep my coffee. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Well, I agree with you. 117.5%. I mean, does that sound like over unity? I mean, what's 100%? What is 117.5%? Come on, shit, this.
If you actually look at just the internal combustion engine alone, it's got such a small percentage of efficiency that it's ridiculous. You're wasting a lot of energy.
Absolutely.
And so, if that can be said about an internal combustion engine, it can also be said about an electric motor or an electric generator.
It can also be said about UV light.
Yeah.
I see it, yet it exists. Think about this a minute. This goes on right along with exactly what you and I have been talking about for the past 2 or 3, 4 years.
Yep.
There is free energy out there. If you don't believe it, duh, you're just not looking because it exists.
Well, I honestly believe that there is a material in existence. And one of the reasons why I say that is because if you look at how bismuth interacts with magnetic fields, they actually are able to put in the bismuth in the right vicinity, get a magnetic field to hold another magnet up in the center, and it doesn't attract to either side. They find a literal levitation point in this field.
So again, we're talking about neutrality.
Yeah.
Right?
So
bismuth back 100 years ago, it existed. We just didn't know about it. Now all of a sudden it's here.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, can it be used? Well, I don't know. So wait a minute. I've been watching for the past couple of days a program on Netflix called Aussie Gold. And all of a sudden, you got all these people that are going to old gold mines in Australia. And what they're doing is they're taking the tailings of the old timers that look for gold.
Yeah.
And they're taking the tailings and finding the gold the old timers just threw away. Because why? It wasn't worth anything. Now, bismuth has existed since the beginning of time. Now, all of a sudden, technology has caught up. So, business has a use. So, I'm going to get stupid here, because I want the people to realize how stupid things really are. I mean, carbon dioxide, oh, it's going to ruin the atmosphere. Come on, man. Oh, climate change. Oh, wow, polar bears are going to die. No, they're not.
Polar bears are good swimmers, you know.
I mean, come on, man. I mean, look, you can dream what you want today. Alright? You can find all the gold there really is. But the problem is, you don't have the technology to find all of it. So what you don't find and you throw away, somebody else in the future will find a way, because then it will become worth more.
Well, it's like back whenever they were actually making gasoline. When the gasoline was very first out there, it was considered a waste product because it was volatile.
No, they weren't making gasoline.
They were making kerosene.
Right. They were making coal oil, fuel oil, kerosene, alcohol, whatever, but gasoline had no use. Now, all of them, it's got a lot of views, and it's worth a lot of money.
Which brings me to my point.
Exactly. That's why I said you're talking 117.5%.
The energy that Skylev is, or Sky Collection is actually producing is high voltage. Right?
Exactly.
It doesn't have a lot of current flow to it, but nonetheless, it's still electricity.
And wait a minute. But once you reach a certain point in voltage, then you get into the plasma effect.
Yeah, but here...
Wait a minute. Hold up. Slow down and look at it. Once you reach the plasma effect, you're getting into the UV area. And the UV area is, UV rays are going to cause cancer in my skin. I mean, wow. What? You can't see it? But you believe it's there? Duh. Come on.
Well, listen.
Wait a minute. One more thing. UV, when it strikes, come in contact with a fluorescent object, it changes its size, shape, form, and or direction. That's what you and I have been talking about for years.
Yeah, so that solves your lighting problem.
Everywhere. It doesn't matter whether you see it or not. It's there.
Alright.
You can change its form, shape, size, and or direction. Now, UV rays are extremely easy to produce.
So, anyway, this brings me down to Ludic's science video that he's got on there, which is, he shows a basic voltage doubler, where you take two capacitors that are running series with each other, and you put a switch in between there. When you have the switch on one side, it will charge one capacitor, and then when you flip the switch to the opposite side, it will charge that capacitor, and now you went from 10 volts to 20 volts because both of these capacitors are charged. And so, if you combine what Ludic Science did and you combined Sky Collection did, now you have a means by which you can actually take that voltage that Sky Collection is producing, charge up a bank, and utilizing transistor technology, be able to do this so rapidly that it would literally be able to keep up with the high voltage that is going on in Sky Collection's generator. And so basically you would have a transistor that would be turning the switch off and on, flip-flopping it back and forth and charging these capacitors up. And that is the reason why a high voltage, why I'm so convinced that high voltage is the way to go as far instead of the whole maximum current flow that you're trying to get immediately out of the generator.
Alright.
Because with Sky Collection's deal, the lens effect at the very least is drastically reduced. And when you charge in these capacitors, until the pressure of the high voltage fills that capacitor completely, then you won't have that lens effect because there's an empty space in there that's being pressurized by that high voltage. By that time, the transistor has already kicked over to the next one and allows that capacitor to fill up next. Now, keep in mind, if you had, let's say you had 1,000 capacitors all in series with each other, and you had a transistor, series of transistors that would take these capacitors and allow you to fill them up individually until it got all the way down to the very end, and when it finally got all the way down to the very end, the last capacitor in, or last transistor in line would trip the switch that would connect all of these together and send that all of that energy in one shot into your load. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, that's
so. So now instead of, if you take 1,000 times 10 volts, that's quite a bit of power that you got, and depending on the microfarad range of each capacitor, it's going to pack a punch at the end. You see what I mean? But meanwhile, your generating system never got bogged down because it never had the chance to invoke the lens effect, and you just shifted all that energy into empty spaces all the way down until it finally got to the very last one and then tripped them and basically send all that power from all the combined capacitors into whatever load it is that you was trying to run. Did you understand that?
Yeah, I did.
All right.
Wait a minute. So if you overload a capacitor, what's going to happen?
Yeah, if you overpressurize it, it's like blowing up a balloon too far, and it'll pop.
Right. So all you do is empty the balloon.
That's right. But I did a video quite some time back called Physics Toy. And in that Physics Toy video, you could actually see how you could literally store air pressure. All right? And, of course, we know we can store air pressure. We've done it before.
Yeah.
And so, essentially, what's going on is when you pressurize that deal, you can move right on to the next empty container and fill it up. And so, you'll never have the time to overpressurize this capacitor to the point where it will pop. It's just going to allow for all that empty space to be filled up rapidly using the high pressure of high voltage until you get down to the point where you have all these run in series, and now you have the combined voltage of all of them plus the pressure that is stored in there, and then you can release that pressure into, let's say, an even larger capacitor bank. You see what I mean?
Yeah, except for what if? What if your larger capacitor bank can't hold it?
Then you have to have a larger one.
But you don't have time for it, so you release it into the atmosphere back where it came from, and then it becomes a lightning bolt, and all of a sudden that lightning going through the air creates nitrogen, and all of a sudden you have rain that falls to the earth and washes the nitrogen out of the air, which is food for plants. Come on, man. I mean, what you're talking about is nature. Whoa. What you're talking about is combining man's ability to work with nature.
Yeah, well, basically what I'm trying to say is if you understand the mechanics of what's actually occurring while you're trying to get this power, you can take this high voltage, which normally you couldn't run anything off of because it doesn't have enough current flow. It doesn't have the wattage and the amperage. But knowing how to build that pressure up and then turn around and use that pressure without invoking other natural laws in the process, you're able to get the best efficiency out of your generating device.
Yes.
So
only what you need, and you release back what you don't need.
Well, you can have a safety circuit on this whole system, whatever you want to, like just basically release it back into the ground or whatever. It's no big deal. But
into the atmosphere.
Yeah. But you can take this high voltage and you can ramp it up to even higher voltage, and then you can use that higher voltage to energize any of the noble gases into the fourth state of matter, being plasma. And now you took that energy and not only ramped it up, but you actually was able to generate, you know, light and heat with it as well.
Right.
And anywhere through this entire process, as long as there's electron flow going through there, LED systems will light up, and fluorescent lighting will light up, and so you can use this system as it's going through without putting a load on it. Just use the electron flow and the high frequency of the voltage to do all your lighting. So you don't even have to plug a light bulb in at the end of the generator, if you understand what I'm saying. You just allow the electron flow to pass through there, and as it's passing through there, The materials in the LED will, you know, when electron flow is introduced into materials in an LED, it will release photons of light, and so there you go. You got light. You haven't even used the generator yet for anything. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
All you did was use the byproduct of what nature's already produced in order to light up your lighting. So now, whatever's coming out the other end, that's what you got left to do, you know, run whatever appliances that you want.
Alright, but do you see what I'm saying? I'm saying there's light. There's light out there that we don't see.
Well, I agree with that, but my point is this. Without ever putting that thing under a load, just a mere act of passing the electron flow through the system, you've already got your light. So light is no longer an option. You already got your lighting covered for your house. You see what I mean? All you did was utilize the force as it was passing through without ever even slowing anything down, without ever invoking lens effect or anything like that, because that electron flow was going somewhere, but it wasn't going right back into the same generator that you're trying to pull the load off. You're just allowing the lighting to be energized in series with the path of wherever you're sending those electrons, and if those electrons are finally going into a spark gap inside of a plasma reactor, where when it finally hits those gases in there and energizes those gas into plasma, that's where your load begins. So you're getting 2-for-1 off this deal. You understand what I'm saying?
See exactly what you're saying, but you're saying get 2-for-1.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. Why 8-for-1?
Well, why not?
Why not? We only see 1/10 of the light spectrum.
Sure.
Wait a minute. What's happening to the other 9%?
It's going off into the atmosphere.
No joke. I almost messed up, okay? Huh. What's going on here? There's an energy out there that we don't see. So if we don't see it, I'm sorry, it don't exist.
Well, that's the point I've been trying to get to for a long time, is that...
We don't see 10% of the light spectrum. So what we see is what we want to use, right? So we see electricity as light.
While we're using the energy from our transformers, our electric motors, our generators, there is a huge magnetic field that surrounds that device.
All right.
And all that energy is being sent off out there in the Nowheresville. It's not being utilized. It's being wasted.
Okay. Wait a minute. Let's think outside the box, okay? So in the box, it's dark. So we need to make a light. So we burn coal, we use nuclear fuel, we're thinking outside the box, because our box is dark. So we punch a hole in the box, and all of a sudden, there's more energy than we can possibly think of coming in through that hole, and what are we going to do about it? Oh, there's light coming in here. So we're going to go over here and... Wait a minute, this thing is upside down. Why? Because you're seeing light that did not exist before you punched a hole in the damn box.
Huh. Anyway.
Outside the box, there's energy everywhere you look.
Yeah, I agree.
You can only see 10% of the energy that is around you. Gamma rays.
Have you ever seen plasma energized into literally white light?
Yes.
Well, one of the things that they do in modern days is fiber optics, and you can literally pipe light wherever you want it. If you think about how fiber optics actually works.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, well, if you got a fiber optic cable, you can run that thing over the river and through the woods, under the hill, around in loop-de-loops, and upside down in every single direction, and that light will literally travel all the way through that cable and then come out the other side.
I understand exactly what you're talking about.
So, if I got a generating system where I'm energizing a noble gas into the fourth state of matter and I'm getting literal white light, I have access to that light that I could then in turn use as fiber optic cables to transfer that light wherever I want to go. And so in a closed system, I wouldn't lose that light either. I wouldn't lose the energy that was flowing through there. I would never invoke the lens effect because I'm not sending that energy back into the same generator that I'm trying to pull the power from. I'm just running it at such a high frequency that not only am I getting heat, I'm getting visible light, I'm getting radiant energy, and every bit of that energy is going somewhere directed to where I want it to go. You see what I mean? So, basically, if you understand how the magnetic flux lines, the shape of the magnetic flux lines, you're sitting here literally looking at a cog in a machine. You're looking at a gear. And if you know which direction to put this gear, and you know how big, you know, like with the pulley systems, you can change the RPMs, the rotations per minute, and you can change the speed up or down, or you can gear it up or down using different size gears facing different directions. And so the same can be done with a magnetic field. I could have a smaller magnetic field to literally spin faster, a vortex, if you understand what I'm saying, like a rotor, or I can have a larger one and literally slow that field down. Does that make any sense to you, Raymond? Where'd you go?
Well, since you have more ice, I'm sorry. Yes, I understand it. Yeah, we're safe because I did that. I rigged up a box of tackle and on my two-stage oscillator. And it didn't work right. Why? Because I thought I knew how block and tackle worked. I mean, you're talking about gears, you're talking about block and tackle, you're talking about cogs, chain. I mean, you think you know what you're doing because that's what you were taught.
Well, with your two-stage oscillator, one of the things that that is really important about that is leverage. For example, if I go over and try to pick up a 100-pound piece of steel, my body ain't designed to pick that 100-pound piece of steel up by myself. But if I took that same 100-pound piece of steel and I could get a really long pipe underneath that and put a some sort of block in the center of that pipe or find the best balance, the longer that pipe is, the more leverage I got. The same thing can be done with magnetism as well.
Wait a minute. The longer your piece of steel, the more flexibility that piece of steel has. So, in reality, if your piece of steel was bigger, stronger, heavier, then you would need near as much of your weight to move that 100 pounds.
I could take your two-stage oscillator, and okay, I could hook up a solenoid to that two-stage oscillator, essentially an electromagnet, and replace your finger.
Right. Now, that's exactly what Jermaine and I were working on.
Yeah, the magnet itself ain't going to be strong to overcome all of that weight. But with that leverage involved in there, now I can take that little bit of magnetic force and use it to pull that weight up off the ground.
All right, wait a minute. What we were working on is we're going to use the magnet to pull itself toward the steel. And at the exact moment, change the polarity. Timing is everything.
Well, I don't think you'd even have to do that if you had a gear involved in there that would like if you got the piece of steel hanging there and the magnet's being attracted to the piece of steel. The arm that's holding the magnet, when it gets to a certain point, is turning a gear as it's going down towards being attracted. And then when it gets to a certain point, it will literally hit a flat spot in the gear, which will allow the gear to slip and drop the metal away from it, so it would never even have a chance to connect.
I don't
like a trip switch.
Explain better.
Like a trip switch, like a trap. You know, like if you got this trap, like a little animal trap that they use for catching live animals. When the animal steps on that trap, it releases the deal, which just closes the door. Well, that's the same thing that would be going on with the gear. That as the gear is turning, it has a trap that before it actually has a chance to travel the space that would actually connect the magnet to the piece of metal, it releases it and drops the piece of metal.
You answered every question I've ever had. Now, right now, you just answered it. I said, at one point, it needs to neutralize.
And that's how you do it.
Rheostat. All of a sudden, the weight of the pendulum is coming down. It's generating power because the weight of the pendulum is being pulled by the gravitational force of the Earth. Now, at one point, it needs to neutralize. So, we have a rheostat that the magnet is pulling itself toward the steel. The Earth is pulling the pendulum toward the Earth. And at one point, the magnet is going to induce power to pull itself toward the steel. But all of a sudden, we need to neutralize it. If we neutralize it, and neither one has a magnetic force, then it's going to pass. Once it passes, it takes very, very little energy.
That's right, and utilizing the down force as well, you can also get the system to reset itself using the right tension spring. So when it drops a piece of metal, as it drops down, it will literally reset itself and come back up so that the next time this thing comes around, it's ready to do the same process again. And all of it's using basically like timing gears on an internal combustion engine that tells the distributor when to fire and when not.
Thomas and I both discussed this. Okay? Now, you can get a lot of force, but eventually, sometime, now you're traveling through space, okay? You're going to use the slingshot effect of going around the planet, and you're going to use a little bit of force to get out of the magnetic pull of the Earth so that you can reach the magnetic pull of another planet. Now, all of a sudden, this other force is free. You're going to go toward it, and all of a sudden, you're going to go around it, and you're going to use a little bit more force to pull away from it, but now you're traveling six times faster than you ever were. Now, you want to go around another one. Now, six times six is 36. What's six times 36? The faster you go, eventually, you're going to reach a point where, I'm going to pass where I want to go. Now, all of a sudden, you need to slow down. You follow what I'm saying?
Well, that's what I've been trying to point out for a long time.
That's exactly what I've been trying to point out.
That's it.
You're right.
One of these anomalies by themselves might not seem like that big of a deal. But if you understand leverage, you understand plumbing, you understand anything about electrical at all and magnetic fields, you can use all these forces to basically time them out to invoke Lenz effect when you want to invoke Lenz effect, like such as in regenerative braking, where whenever they push their feet on the brake, it actually produces a magnetic field, and then whenever they let their foot off the brake, that collapsing field actually creates back EMF that puts juice back into your battery.
117.5% again, Shaziz, when you produce more energy than you need, then you need to put it back.
What I've been saying for all this time is that we're already doing that. We're wasting energy.
Wait a minute. Where you need it. You've collected all this energy, and you don't need all this energy. Then put it back where you need it.
That's the whole key of what I'm trying to get, is that we are going to guide the energy where we want to go, because we already know all of the effects that occur in all the different directions of how we use electricity.
Okay.
So what Sky Collection has done right here is literally put a mechanical mind to how electricity and energy actually travels.
Okay, right. Now you're talking.
So
again.
Now that we know the mechanics of how magnetism, regardless, it doesn't matter to me what magnetism actually is. We know what it does. And that force right there, we know how to utilize that force, not only on the way out to get work done, but as that field is collapsing, we can grab that energy up from the other direction as well. Because nature's trying to balance itself out. Doesn't matter which direction the wind blows, the windmill, the blades are going to turn. And reason for that is they put a tail on the back of that windmill so that it will guide itself into the wind. And so if the wind is blowing from the north, the propellers are still turning. If it's blowing from the south, east, west, whatever, it doesn't matter, because that system will literally guide itself to where the energy flow is, and that is what needs to be done. And all these generators that people are trying to do, and you know, they're trying to get over unity out. They don't need to get over unity or even zero point, not putting any energy in. What they need to know is the mechanics of how this energy, which direction it's flowing, how it's going to, how it's pressurized. And they would be able to make that generator so incredibly efficient and be able to utilize all the forces that are occurring while that thing is running, and there would be no waste.
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you. Because there are so many people that don't realize what you're talking about. Okay, so we're going to put a wind vane that's going to turn the propellers into the wind. And all of a sudden, the wind picks up, so the wind vane is going to turn the propellers into the wind, and your propellers are really big.
Yep.
But can they stand the force?
And
why are you saying that HAVTs explode? They burn up. Why? Because they're trying to collect too much damn energy. More than they can use. Release it.
Yeah, find a place for it to go. That's the whole thing.
Okay, right.
And even in solar power, solar cells, where they're saying that solar panels are only efficient half the day because you only get sunlight half the day, that's because as much energy is coming down, they haven't figured out yet how to utilize all that energy. First off, if I got a solar panel array, and my solar panel array, because of the heat generated by the sun, will become less efficient the more heat is involved, then I can only use so much energy off of that deal. I can store some of that energy into a battery bank, and if I was wise, I could actually store some into a capacitor bank as well, so not only would I have power available in the batteries, I would have pressure available in the capacitor, such as like on a electric motor, you have a capacitor that is used for starting that motor, because if that motor is under a load, you can't just use normal current to start that motor up, because the force that's holding that motor back is enough that it will slow that thing down to where all that energy that you just put into the copper wire will cause that that coil to get so hot that it will burn itself out. And so you need some sort of jump start. So you have this pressure in the capacitor that will literally punch that thing in the face and get it rolling. You see what I mean? And so the heat that is generated could also be stored. And the heat could be turned into multiple things, like hot water. And hot water could also be turned into pressure. So you could literally build a tank that would hold water that was only half full, and as that water heated, it would pressurize the atmosphere in that tank, which is in turn that pressure would be forced over into a storage tank, and now you not only got hot water, but you have air pressure as well. What do you think?
I'm trying to digest what she just said.
What happens when you push? What happens when you boil water into a sealed container?
You build a lot of pressure.
Yeah, if you take a can of soup and you throw it out in a burn pile, you know, or your barbecue pit or whatever, and the can of soup.
Wait a minute! I've heard this story before.
Yeah.
You do that,
it will blow up.
Out of the way. Get out of the way.
It will blow up. Literally. It will overpressurize and it will blow up.
So don't put it in there.
Yeah, but if you want to take that heat off of that solar panel and utilize that heat to literally boil water because of the heat, and if you know how to use surface area and different size of tubing or whatever, you can literally regulate the temperature of the water by the size of the tubing. Like if I just want the water to be warm, I'll use a big tube so it's more area that the panel has to heat. But if I want to get more heat out of that more rapidly, I'd use a smaller tube so that it's less amount of surface area that heat actually has to transfer into, which would make that water hotter when it come out the other side. And if I'm putting that hot boiling water into a tank that I'm only allowing this tank to get half full with water, and that water is boiling inside there, it is pressurizing the atmosphere inside that doggone tank, and that pressure can be bled off into another storage tank where I could literally store pressurized air.
All right, wait a minute. Why do we need to boil the water?
I'm just saying, listen, here's the point. The solar panel by itself, it will gather energy. But the solar panel with a thermoelectric generator attached to it, a system that will actually transfer the heat away from it, will become more efficient. And so I'm not just using the solar panel to generate electricity. I'm also using it to heat my water. I'm using it to do some thermoelectric exchange as well, because let's say I got this these tubing with all the hot water flowing through it that is taking the heat off of the solar panel and taking that hot water away. If I have a Peltier element on the back of that, and there is a heat sink on the back of the Peltier element, the temperature difference right there is going to be enough that's actually going to produce yet even another charge that I can utilize.
You're talking about what we discussed about 6 or 8 months ago. If you cool the backside of a solar panel, you increase its productivity.
Yeah. So my
okay.
point.
Now, wait a minute. If we take the heat off the backside, what are we going to do with it? We're going to throw it away.
No, we're going to use it to boil water. We're going to use it to heat water or whatever.
Wait a minute. We don't need to boil the water.
I'm just saying, Raymond, listen, there is the potential because there is so much energy.
Yes.
There is the potential to do it all.
That's my point I'm trying to make. You don't need to boil the water. You just need to take the heat off the backside of the solar panel. Now, if you take the heat off the backside of the solar panel, what have you done? You've collected the energy that you cannot see. The gamma rays, the UV rays, the mega rays, whatever. And you've turned it into heat.
Yeah.
And now, you're taking the heat off. You don't need to boil the water. You don't want to boil the water because water boils at 212 degrees at sea level.
Yeah.
Okay? But you're heating this water. You don't need to boil it. You don't even want to boil it.
It doesn't matter whether you need to.
Wait a minute. You want to take the heat off the back side of the panel. Why? So the panel can produce more energy, making it more efficient. Now, what are you going to do with this heat? Turn it into a Stirling engine.
Yeah, but listen, man. It doesn't... You're missing my point.
But you're not with me.
It doesn't matter whether you need to boil it or whether you even want to boil it. The capability is there. The backside of that solar panel is going to be extremely hot.
117.5%.
Yeah.
But again.
But listen.
You've got all this heat.
But listen.
You're going to throw it away or are you going to use it?
There are other
ways to use it.
Sure. All the energy that the sun is putting around that solar panel,
you can
gather it up in so many different directions that solar panel itself is not only super efficient by itself, but it also has all the light spectrums that weren't involved in getting the solar panel that are actually generating heat on the surface of the solar panel because of the color of it or whatever absorbing qualities the material was made of or whatever. There's materials out there that you can use to intentionally absorb heat that will retain the heat long after the doggone sun goes down. It's like I give that example about, it was in the middle of summer. In the middle of the night, I get in the back of a pickup truck that had been sitting out in the sun all night, and I sat down on the back of this tire in the back of the pickup truck, and I burnt my biscuits.
There you go.
Because that dang tire was still hot, because it had absorbed heat all day long, but for some reason, that rubber was able to retain that heat, and the metal of the rim itself is transferring heat as well.
All right, question. When you sit down on it and it burnt your biscuit, if you did not sit down on it, what would happen to it?
Yeah.
It would be dissipated into the air.
Yeah, eventually it would have cooled down.
What we're talking about right now is how do we store that heat?
Multiple ways.
How do we store it or how do we use it? And you're talking about capacitors?
Sure.
All right, okay. So when your capacitor is full and you didn't need all the heat, what are you going to do with it?
What I'm trying to...
where it was meant to go.
Yeah, what I'm trying to point out is that any energy out there can be stored. It doesn't matter what type of energy we're talking about. You can store it. You can store heat. You can store pressure. You can store, every form of electricity. There's AC capacitors, there's DC capacitors, there's methods by which you can take all this different forms of energy and store it. Right now, they're saying that solar panels are only so efficient, and that is because all the rest of what they could have been doing with the same system has been ignored. It's okay, maybe it's too expensive to retrofit your solar panel to boil water or just heat water or utilize the temperature difference between the back of the solar panel and the wind blowing behind your solar panel to make a thermoelectric charge, as well as the sunlight shining through the solar panel the way it naturally functions. What I'm saying is you could take all that energy that would that is actually passing through that doggone solar panel, and you can use it in the extent that even long after the sun went down, you not only have the power stored in your battery, but you got warm water, hot water, or whatever, you got pressure that you can use to run like a pneumatic motor or something. You see what I mean? Are you still there? So anyway, you can take, if you understand the mechanics of what's going on around all these different systems, you can utilize what would have normally been waste energy. High voltage, high frequency is not something you want to run your computer on. But if you can take that high voltage and high frequency, and you can change that energy into a form of energy that can run your computer. And even in the process of running your computer, you're producing yet even more waste energy. That's why there's heat sinks on your transistors and your processors on your computer, because as the resistance is coming through that deal, it's actually generating heat. And that heat right there could literally be guided to wherever you want it to go. You could literally use your PC to warm your water up, and just like my redneck hot tub, maybe it's going to take you 4 hours to heat that sucker up, but once you get it heated up, it doesn't take hardly anything at all to maintain it, because you've got a constant flow of energy transfer into that water. That's my point. And so,
wait a minute. Can I make a point?
Yeah.
Do you realize that all you have to do is measure how much energy you need, and then compare that to how much energy you want, and then compare that to the size of the area on the face of the earth you really need, and then take into consideration the size of your body. Now wait a minute, I'm going with a scenario here. If you could take all of the energy that's produced by the sun, it's free, and scale it down to what you need, and say, whoa, I'm satisfied. And then you say, well, wait a minute, I'm satisfied. Can I go to the Bahamas, lay on the beach, and soak up a little sun? Come on, wait a minute. In reality, there's more than enough wind power in one state, in the United States, to produce all of the energy the United States needs. In one day, produce more energy than we need in a year. Now, wait a minute. Okay. So let's take sunlight. Sunlight throughout the entire Earth over a 24-hour period is more energy than the entire world would need for 10 years.
Well,
In one hour, there's more electricity and lightning bolts than the entire world would need for 10 years.
Sure.
But lightning, that serves a purpose. Okay? So why would we want to capture all this lightning? No. You don't want to capture lightning. You want to capture the electricity before it becomes lightning.
When I get somebody willing to pay attention to me,
okay,
who wants to sit down with a 2,500 watt generator, I will take and show you how you can utilize all the energy off of that 2,500 watt generator with a few minor modifications to run your entire house.
No joke.
Your entire house off of a 2,500 watt generator. When I get somebody who's really serious about paying attention to what I have to say, and we make the modifications to that generator, you'll see exactly what I've been trying to point out all along. It will take that energy off of that generator, and every bit of energy that that generator is capable of producing, including every bit of waste energy that it produces, including the exhaust itself, where by the time this is all said and done, you can run a second generator off of just the fumes of the first generator. Now, if you think I'm crazy, try me out. Because if you look at any of the internal combustion engines right now, your car, go outside and take a look at your car. There is a catalytic converter on there. And that catalytic converter does one thing. It is a reburner of waste fuel because they can't get a decent, clean burn off of it. And so what they do is they take the materials that absorb a lot of heat and the vibration of the exhaust rumbling through it as well to produce enough friction and heat to cause that thing to get so incredibly hot that this thing will take any excess gases that make it through the exhaust port of the internal combustion engine that don't get burned up in the combustion cycle and send it down through and basically reburn that fuel so that it burns off most of the crud. Not all of it, because you still got carbon emissions coming out the back. And so that catalytic converter, long after you shut your vehicle down, will remain hot for hours after you shut it down. Anybody who thinks I'm crazy about that, go get you a thermometer or one of those digital temperature readers and run, go out there and drive your car around the block for a little while. Come home, set that thing down, start the stopwatch, hit that thing with the thermometer, measure the temperature, come back 2 hours later, do it again, and decide whether or not you want to put your finger on it.
Laser thermometer.
Yeah. So, essentially...
Hey, it only costs $7.
Yeah. So, essentially, what you got right there is energy storage in that catalytic converter. And without that catalytic converter, you got the raw exhaust of whatever isn't burned up in the combustion cycle that is coming out, which is actually fuel, vaporized fuel that could be put right back into a second engine that you can run that same fuel twice.
Wait a minute. Why don't we redesign the engine to burn the fuel more efficiently? Well, therefore, you don't need a catalytic.
Because sometimes, Raymond, simplicity is the best way to get your point across. Simplicity is...
Now you're talking, okay?
If you try to tell somebody, you know, to reinvent the wheel, then suddenly they get frustrated. Well, you know, you got to engineer this, and that costs too much money. And I'm saying, well, look, if it's engineered properly to begin with, you wouldn't be able to do this because you would get such a clean burn and you would have the energy focused exactly and only where you needed it. And you could run this engine all day long and then come up, put your hand on it and not get burned.
No shit. Really?
Oh,
no
man. So, anyway.
All right. You and I are on the same page. We just use different words.
Yep.
Hey, collect what you need.
Yep.
Think about what you'd really like to have. And go a little bit further.
Yeah, well, right now, just using an existing generator out there, if somebody wanted to make it so that they could run their house using technology that's already in existence, go look at a school bus. Take a look at how that school bus works. When you look at the heating system and the cooling system on that school bus, you're going to be amazed at something that you can do. That's just one little example how using modern technology with some older technology that you can literally, instead of having to use that generator to run an electric heater, you can use the heat generated by that motor to produce heat for your house. Basically using a radiator type system. Even when those things are running, you don't want to go up and touch the radiator on a school bus that's been out running around all day. Because the radiator, even though its job is to disperse and take away the heat from that engine so the engine doesn't tear itself apart, is still producing in anywhere from 160 to 180 to 220 degrees Fahrenheit. Which, water boils at 212 degrees at sea level.
At sea level, I like that.
So, nonetheless, it's hot. There's still... Even after I use the heat to warm the entire inside of the bus, there's still heat left over. That heat left over could be in turn used as well. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. I really do.
So, when I decide I'm going to use my house, the biggest load in my house is going to be the heating and cooling. And if I know the dynamics of heating and cooling, HVAC, then I know that I know how to literally take heat and turn it into cold, and vice versa. So if I can take the heat off of that engine, and I can turn that heat into AC, and if I need heat, I got heat. If I need cold, I got cold. And all I'm doing is using the waste energy of the generator. I don't have to plug in an electric motor. I don't have to plug in an electric heating element to cook my food. All I'm using is what's already happening in that engine to transfer the heat energy where I need it. You know, copper is a good conductor of not only electricity, but it's also a good conductor of heat. That's why if you go out and find these pans that are copper coated on the bottom, it will evenly disperse that heat across that pan and you'll be able to cook things on it better. So, we know that we can transfer heat through copper. We know that we can use that heat transfer through copper to literally put our frying pans on there and use that temperature to cook our food. So I just cooked my food with the heat from that engine. I heated my house with the heat from that engine. And I used the electron flow of the electricity that I was taking off of the generator head to run LED systems or even turn it into a higher frequency and run a fluorescent lighting system with it. But at no time have I ever had to plug anything major into that doggone generator. So why would it take me a 10,000 or 12,000 watt or higher generator to run my house if I took and utilized what was already going on in there? I got my heat off this generator. I got my lighting off this generator. I got my warm water, which was part of the heat. And I was able to cook my food off of the heat that was generated through the radiating system of the generator itself. And out of this whole deal, never bogged my generator down, so I used actually less fuel than I would have used if I ran it the traditional method where I plug everything directly into it, which puts the generator head under load, invoking lens effect, which in turn causes that generator to bog down, which in turn causes the fuel system to have to work harder and put more fuel in there to keep up with the demand of the energy that I'm trying to get out of it. You see what I'm saying?
Amen.
You just took, and instead of trying to get out more than you put in, you just utilized every bit of energy available that thing was capable of to become more efficient, use less fuel, and you would literally be able to run any household off the equivalence of a 2,500 watt generator. Plain and simple.
Amen.
So imagine if you got a big old 10,000 watt with a diesel engine on it and whatever. Anybody who thinks I'm crazy, that's fine.
Wait,
go get you one of those. How much did you say those laser tincture things cost?
$7.
All right, go buy you one. $7 and take temperature readings off of your generator while you're running it normally under your normal load, whatever it is that you're pulling off of that. And take that temperature, take the output that you're actually draining off of it, do the maths on that, and then tell me that thing isn't producing more energy than you're using. Literally.
Literally.
If you take and do the calculations of how much gasoline you're actually using, and you do the math on that, and you do the math on the temperature of it, and you do the math on the output of it, you're going to find out that you're not getting out more energy than you're actually putting in, because you're not utilizing that fuel in the proper fashion where you're getting the best clean controlled burn of that fuel.
One more time. Amen.
Huh. See, the thing about it is, a lot of people overlook the fact that whenever you're running an internal combustion engine, the harder you step down on that gas pedal, the more fuel you push through there, the faster those valves are opening and closing, and the less time, this is the key, the less time that there is for that fuel to completely burn. So the way that it should be done is that the harder you step down on that gas pedal, the less amount of fuel goes into that combustion chamber, because you don't need that amount of fuel. You need to have it timed out so that you're only putting in to that combustion chamber the amount of fuel needed to literally create the combustion, which creates the force that pushes down the piston and turns the camshaft on down the line there. So by vaporizing that fuel before you ever even put it in, you just made it more efficient. By raising the temperature of the fuel before you even vaporize it, before you put it in, you just made it more efficient. You get this thing started, you energize that fuel before, and you get it ready. You start prepping that fuel before it ever even goes into the intake portion of the combustion chamber. Then you heat it up, you vaporize it, and then when it needs, you put in only the amount necessary to produce the force that creates the downward thrust that slams the piston to the bottom. That way, when you're running this thing, the faster you run this thing, the less amount of fuel you're going to have to use, because you're going to shorten that time. The faster those pistons are coming up and down, you're not going to be able to burn as much fuel as you're trying to cram down that deal. It's not going to make it any more powerful by cramming more fuel down in there. The hot rod guys have tried it all the time. They get some pretty impressive results, but they always end up backing off the timing or advancing the timing or doing something to allow that to burn longer inside there to produce more pressure, and they can't get past the laws of physics and the time that is necessary to get a proper burn decreases the faster that engine has to turn. Think I'm wrong?
No. You know, I've heard from guys that like to race fast cars with gasoline that they actually use what we call it, dry ice, to freeze the gasoline so they can put more gasoline in the engine.
Well, if you're cramming more molecules, if you're the way to cram more molecules in there and ignite it all in one shot, I can understand that concept.
But these same guys are using turbo. They're using turbo dynamics. They're forcing more air with the gas.
Yeah.
Because the gas is now colder and it's more condensed, so the forcing more air in with the gas. Why? Why? So it will burn cleaner, but it doesn't. Why not just reduce the amount of gasoline and increase the amount of oxygen? Why not?
Well, because
they ain't figured it out yet. You're right. They haven't figured it out.
And I'm sitting here telling them, you know, you're using too much fuel. That's the problem. You know?
Exactly.
If you can smell the fuel coming out of there, you're not burning it properly. Period.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, if anybody really seriously interested and they want to know how, what I'm saying, if you listen to what I'm talking about take a 2,500 watt generator and do some measurements on how much heat is actually generated by that thing, and then think about how you're actually trying to pull that energy off of that generator, and then we'll have a talk. Because if that thing was properly engineered from start to finish.
Can I say something really stupid?
I suppose.
Okay. Now, take your cutting torch, all right? Your torch. And turn the acetylene off. Turn your oxygen on. Fire up your generator. Put your torch over your air intake and hit your oxygen lever and see what happens. Your generator will explode. You need to be wearing Kevlar face mask and everything else because you're going to get hurt because you're putting too much gasoline into your engine. You're not putting enough air into it.
Yep.
Air doesn't mean jack shit.
Ah!
Excuse my foul language. I'm sorry she says, but if oxygen and gas, olean.
Alright, we gotta take a music break.
Scepter technology. Приступила к производству компьютеров персональный спутник.
Continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
It's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. Got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Because when the old boys raise their own shotguns, from the west Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
And we're back. So, with that said, apologize for that, folks. So basically, we actually use... We waste more energy than we use. That's what I was trying to say. So, it'd be the equivalence of using a cannon when it only took a BB gun. So, if you understand the mechanics of what's going on with magnetism and how it is that we actually generate the energy that we use as far as the electricity, as we call it, to run our appliances and such, then you can find that not only do you get more efficiency, but the problems that usually come about, like when you're running an electric motor, the longer you run it, the hotter it's going to get. And after a while, friction takes its toll, and the temperature builds up in the core of the motor itself. And when it gets to a certain point, every single thing out there has a thermal breakdown point. And so if you got an electric motor that is not allowing the temperature of the core itself and even the coils to be taken away, then eventually the insulation on that copper winding will fail. And once the copper winding insulation fails, then you end up, which is the equivalence of a short circuit. Instead of having 1,000 turns on this winding, All these thousand turns are now fused into one solid short circuit, which allows all that energy to cram itself in there all at one time. You want to be able to guide this energy where you want it to go, as you're going to use that magnetic field being expanded to get the work done that you want. But if for some reason the insulation on the wires fail, well, that just basically short circuits it. And so that's the equivalent to taking a solid wire and touching both ends of a battery terminal. All that energy can rush in there instantaneously through that wire to try to balance that battery back out, and what you end up with is a really hot wire and potentially a battery explosion. So if you understand how this energy is actually transferring from one material to the next, you could literally design an electric motor that would keep itself so cool that not even the friction of the bearings would make a difference. And you could run this electric motor forever, and it would never fail. As long as the insulation of that that electric motor stays intact, then that motor will never burn up, because the copper atom hasn't changed. Even if you was to liquefy the copper wires itself, as long as it's not able to break that circuit, then that motor would still run. So even if that temperature of that copper got so hot that it was literally in electrical liquid form, as long as the insulation between each of those windings stayed intact, that motor would still run. As crazy as that sounds, that's the way it works. But if you want that insulation to never fail, then you got to make sure that that insulation never reaches its thermal breakdown point. Now, we've got materials these days that you could literally design an insulation that you could coat that wiring with that wouldn't fail, that would be so temperature resistant that you could get that motor as hot as you wanted and it wouldn't be a problem. But the whole key is to take away that wasted heat energy generated by either the friction of the bearing or the resistance of the wire itself as the electrical current was flowing through there and constantly running. That energy will gradually build up. It will continue to build up. The longer that fan is on, the hotter that core is going to get, and the hotter those coils are going to get. You can see what it is that I'm saying, even if you just take something as simple as a little transformer and measure the temperature on that transformer and see that while that transformer, either step up or step down transformer, is under a load, and even when it's not under load, when it's just sitting there idle, it stays warm because it's still plugged in and there's current flow going through it. So there's resistance in that wire that is producing friction, which in turn is producing heat, and eventually if it gets too hot, it will ruin the insulation on the windings, which will make it, instead of a thousand turns, down to, you know, a lesser amount, which will produce yet even more resistance, which will in turn produce yet even more heat, and eventually the thing will fail. No electric motor would ever fail as long as the insulation stayed intact, period. And there's different types of ways to cool down equipment. We've seen heat sinks on the back of the transistors and MOSFETs and different types of processors that we use inside our computers that have these heat sinks that allow the atmosphere and the fan to take away that heat that is built up by the resistance. And so with that said, we even have the capability to literally take our electric motors and make them so incredibly efficient that they won't burn up. Like I said, the only reason why they ever burn up is when it gets too hot and either burns the wire in half and there's no way to contain that metal to keep it together, or the insulation itself fails, which usually ends up in the thing, wire getting so hot that it burns itself in half because of the oxygen that surrounds it. It's capable of doing that. a light bulb with a tungsten element, the only reason why it doesn't burn in half even though it's under resistance is because it's in a vacuum and doesn't have the oxygen available to get hot enough to be able to burn itself in half. So, with that said, we got everything necessary to literally build electric motors or even generators that won't tear themselves apart. And utilizing just existing technology alone, we have the capability of literally utilizing every bit of waste energy, re-guiding this energy where we want it to go, as opposed to just being let off into the air out there. I mean, think about this for a second. If you got a gasoline generator, and it's sitting outside, and it's hotter than all get out outside, not only is it picking up sun from the generator itself, or picking up heat from the generator, things going on in the generator itself, but it's also picking up radiant energy off of the sun and the environment around it. So if you put that, something simple as putting that doggone generator in the shade, now you have made that generator a little bit more efficient just by putting it in the shade, just taking it out of the sunlight. It's not getting as hot as it would be if it was sitting in the direct sun. So a little bit of common sense and some basic knowledge about mechanics and physics and, you know, basic science and, you know, temperatures and such like that. You take all these things in conjunction with each other, and you can utilize what would have normally been waste product of the engine itself and the environment around it, and utilize all these forces to produce more than enough energy to do the work necessary to keep your house cool when it needs to be cool, and keep it warm when it needs to be warm, do your cooking and the water and all that kind of stuff. So even if you can't afford a big old massive solar array, you could take what knowledge you gain right here on the Mad Science Channel today and modify slightly an existing generator, or even go out and buy you one that already has a water jacket involved in it, something that requires a radiator to run. That radiator will circulate water through a tubing system that you could either embed in the floor, and since we know heat rises as that tubing is embedded in the floor, as the hot water is circulating through there and going in and out of wherever you need the hot water to be, that heat radiated through the floor will actually rise up and keep the place warm. And then during the summertime, when you obviously don't want that heat going up through the floor, then you can use something such as a bypass valve to literally send it off into a different direction to wherever you need it. Maybe this time you send that hot water in and you turn it into air pressure or steam pressure that you can then in turn turn into air conditioning as well. Because we know that anytime we pressurize a gas, the gas will not only heat up, but it will expand and pressurize. And then if you allow that to go into an expansion chamber rapidly, it will have the complete and opposite effect of heat. That's how an air conditioner works. You have an air conditioner pump that circulates freon through your system, and as it's is being circulated, it goes into a compressor pump, which causes it to get hot and pressurized. And then that goes into an expansion chamber, which is released rapidly, that in turn creates a cooling effect and takes the heat away from one side and brings the cool in. So you have basically a heat exchanger. And some people have even been known to take these air conditioners during the winter time and turn them around backwards and use them for heaters in the house, because all it's doing is the opposite. If you ever looked at walk outside your house, standing behind the air conditioner, and you'll see that it's got heat going, as well as you will see that there is a temperature difference outside in the atmosphere, as opposed to the temperature difference that is the heat being escaping from the back of the air conditioner, and you will notice that there is moisture built up, so you literally have condensation. You're pulling water out of the air. It's drying it out on the inside of your house, and it's producing water that's running out the back of your air conditioner. So you just basically brought forth a new energy force. And the water itself that is generated from the back could be used for multiple purposes. It could be used to cool that air conditioner down to make it yet even more efficient. It could also be used to be separated into hydrogen and oxygen for another fuel. Or it could be boiled into steam and pressurized once again to maybe run the air conditioning for the next room over. So it ain't about the fact that we ain't got enough energy. It's about that we're not utilizing it to its maximum potential. Everything that we use. Electric motors, internal combustion engines, it doesn't matter. All of our electronics, everything, is we're basically wasting more energy than it is that we're actually using. Even when they send the power down the high tension power lines, if you actually paid attention to how this stuff is actually being sent to you, and then how it's actually being turned into energy that you can use, you can't plug your toaster right directly into the power line. It's just not going to work. The instantaneous surge of that amount of voltage is going to fry your toaster and potentially you if you're close enough. So that's not a good move. But the technology necessary to step that voltage down and put it into a usable AC current that you can use in your house in whichever phase you need, one, two, or three phase electricity at whatever volt range that you're using. And from that point on, depending on what appliance that you might have to have another transformer to step it down yet even further, like as in to run your digital alarm clock. It only takes 9 volts AC or 9 volts DC to run a digital alarm clock, yet you're using 120 volts AC through a step down transformer in order to produce that smaller amount of voltage so that you don't destroy that piece of equipment. So if the industry out there really was concerned about energy usage and carbon footprint, as they all like to say, then we could already have done. We've had the technologies existed for so many years, it's ridiculous. We've already had the technology to utilize that force that we call electricity and magnetism in such an incredibly efficient manner that you're barely using any fuel. You know, the amount of power that is in just one little tiny cloud of fuel is incredible. And proof of concept is the story that was been told on here many times about coffee creamer, and the story that has been told about why it is that you don't want to go into a grain bin and light up a smoke with all that grain dust around. You get a massive explosion. Now, if you take that solid stuff right there and you get it hot enough, yeah, it'll burn. But if you vaporize anything, you turn it into fuel. Even when you're burning your firewood in your chimney, it's building up extra fuel. Wood gasification systems basically turn, any biological product or whatever, wood or sticks or paper, whatever, all of the same come from trees, whatever. Plants takes that and basically takes all the gas out of it and uses it for fuel. I mean, they were running back in World War One or World War Two Jeeps and trucks and things off of wood gasifiers. So energy comes from all different directions. And the crazy thing is about wood gasification, once the material inside the gasifier doesn't work any longer, it's got all the energy taken out of it, what you end up with is carbon. That's it. You end up with carbon. And what can you do with it? Google it. Google what you can do with pure carbon. Anyway, the point is, with this video that I posted up there of Sky Collection and the way that he runs his coil systems and stuff and electric motors and experiments that he does and the lens effect and so many more, magnetic levitation as far as bearing wise, to reduce friction, and the results that he's getting are so incredibly impressive. And Ludic Science that did this little example, I like his videos because the way that he explains electronics and circuitry to people, it makes it so much easier for the average Joe to understand what's being said here. And so that's why you always hear me bucking the system when it comes down to high-tech terminology and all that kind of stuff, because I want everyone out there to understand that you have access to more energy than you will ever need. Even utilizing existing technology right now, if you only got a 2,500 watt generator and that's all you can afford, then you can take that 2,500 watt generator and modify it. Most of those generators out there are air cooled. If you get a generator that has a water jacket, you're halfway to the goal there, because now you can actually take that water instead of just allowing that energy to disperse the heat out into the air, which is there only for the purpose of cooling that engine. Utilize it for other things like cooking and heating and stuff like that. You just double what you would have been getting out of that thing. And so with the air cooled, you have to modify it to, copper tubing around the vent, something that was going to absorb that heat energy that is being radiated out and still allow that engine to be able to remain at the right operating temperature. And if you get an engine that will run at the perfect temperature where nothing in that engine will reach its thermal breakdown, in the world of oil, there's a term called viscosity, which literally means the thickness of that oil, the consistency of that oil. And when it's in its perfect state, the oil will not only be able to pump easier when it's just warm enough for it to be a little thinner, but not warm enough, not hot enough to where it actually begins to break down and reduces the amount of lubrication that protects the parts inside that machinery. If you can keep that oil at the perfect temperature, several things are going to happen here. One of which is that those parts will never fail. And if you can keep the carbon out of the blow by of the carbon that is actually making it past the rings of the piston in an internal combustion engine out of that oil, then that oil will never even have to be changed. If you have a system underneath that piston that would basically filter out any kind of crud that might be accidentally blowing by that piston, and it never can transfer into the oil, no kind of shavings or anything like that, as long as the piston itself doesn't get too hot and reach its thermal breakdown or the rings or whatever, and they start eating into each other, the cylinder walls, then that engine will not fail. As long as you regulate the temperature throughout this entire engine to where nothing can, you find the least amount of thermal breakdown. Let's say your cylinder walls or your rings are the weakest link in the deal. You know the maximum amount before that metal will actually reach its thermal breakdown and it will begin to fail if it gets to this certain temperature, because the material itself will actually become softer and anything harder will start to grind into it. So if you got this engine running at the perfect temperature, there is no way physically possible any part of this engine can reach its thermal breakdown, and that engine will never fail. No maintenance would ever even be necessary. You wouldn't have to change the oil. You wouldn't even need an oil filter if the engine was engineered properly. The only purpose for the oil would be for lubrication. That's it. And there wouldn't be no reason to have to keep changing oil because you're not allowing what happens in your normal combustion chamber to occur. You have literally kept that cylinder pressurized to the point where nothing, not even in the microns, tiniest, smallest molecule could literally pass through as that combustion cycle is occurring. So, if you got a way to keep your oil perfectly clear, which right now our best is using doggone oil filters, and in the fuel portion of it, we use a fuel filter to keep out any small particles that might be sucked in with the fuel and then sent down into the combustion chamber, and little microscopic pieces of metal start tearing into the cylinder walls and acting like sandpaper and destroying that as well. But with the process of only putting the fuel in necessary, now you don't have a flow of liquid that can carry any particles with it. These particles won't magically connect themselves to the side of a gasoline atom or whatever in the vaporization of the deal, and so there's no way that you're ever going to be able to plug up your injectors or your fuel system. There's no way that any crud can even get by there because you're not sending it directly in like you would in the standard internal combustion engine that we use today. Now, a lot of people would think, well, you know, if that could be done, they'd already be doing it. Well, and if they did, they wouldn't sell auto parts anymore because auto parts wouldn't fail. There's a word out there called planned obsolescence. You sell somebody a light bulb that lasts forever, then you don't have to sell them a light bulb ever again. So that light bulb at some point has to fail. And that's the way it's designed. Just like the internal combustion engine is designed to break down. From the time you bought it, it is going to break down. You're like basically playing, it's a gambling thing. You know, you're driving around, you got all this faith in your brand new car, everything. It's a brand new car, everything's fine. But as you're driving down the road between the banging around of the chuck holes in your fine government paved roads, everything's being banged on, it's being attacked by friction, it's being attacked by the elements outside, the air, everything around you. And so the body of your car begins to rust from the salt that they put on the road or chemistry or wherever you live. Maybe you live out by the ocean and that salt there is beginning to attack it. We have the technology literally to protect our vehicles by coating certain materials that are prone to rust, oxidization or whatever, and making them so that they won't rot. Literally. So, back down to the average Joe. If worst case scenario and the power grid went down and all you had was a 2500 watt generator and you utilized the forces of what you had and even understood that even if you couldn't get a hold of gasoline, that there are materials available out there in the trash that you could actually make gasoline with, or even build your own gasifier system, or hydrogen cell. There are many different types of fuels that will actually burn in an internal combustion engine. And so you really wouldn't have to worry about, as long as you paid attention in your science and mechanics or whatever, that there were different types of fuels that you could run that same piece of machinery on. And instead of plugging in an electric heater into the output of that generator, you take the waste heat off of that generator and you pump that into your house. that will leave you all the rest of that voltage that the generator is capable of producing for much smaller and loads that are basically not going to drain power off of that generator like the standard use would be, as if you plugged it right straight in. It would very, at the very least, reduce the lens effect to the extent that your generator is more efficient than it would have been if you'd have run it the way that it was, you know, at the way that they are being ran now. And that voltage is high enough that you can literally energize a noble gas into the fourth state of matter, producing plasma. You can take that energy, which is heat and light, and you can turn that heat, energy, and light into it, whatever form of electricity that you want. Looks like we got Thomas calling in. How you doing, Thomas? We're live. Are you there?
Bleepity bleep bleep bleep.
Raymond already did that. All right. Well, that means I got to edit today. All right. Well, anyway, what we've been talking about is mechanics of magnetism and ways that basically we can make things more efficiently. Sky Collection is one of the YouTubers that I watch. He does some really amazing deals with pancake coils and shows different ways to not literally get around the lens effect, but not invoke the lens effect by the way that these coils are used. And he's getting some really incredible results as far as like the RPMs that this little motors that he puts together generate. And way that the energy is transferred from what he's putting in to on the opposite side, and how the actual energy is actually being changed or whatever. I say that if anybody in this world ever reaches over unity, it's going to be him, because his work is just, it's spectacular, to say the least. And then Ludic Science, which is another guy out there that he shows how different types of circuitries, like this voltage doubler, he explains it into a method by which people can understand it. You know, the average Joe paying attention would understand exactly what it is that he's showing. And so that's why I like his deal. But if you take his voltage doubler and you connect it with Sky Collection's generating system, now you got a way that you can literally take a high frequency, high voltage, and put it back into usable current that would run the crummy appliances that we've got access to. So, that was a lot to say. What do you think about all that? Anything? No?
Bueller.
Oh? Bueller? Number 9? Bueller. Alright, so, anyway, if modern day industry doesn't want to do it, then think of the average Joe going to have to do it. You're going to have to experiment with different things that you've got and begin to understand how energy actually travels. Forget all the high-tech terminology. You know what magnets do. You know which directions you can turn them to get whichever reactions. You can use a magnetic field just like a gear in a machine. You can manipulate the size of the magnetic field. You can manipulate the direction of the polarity. And so with that said, you can literally build perfect electric motors to do whatever task that you want it to do. There's no need for any metal cores in any of the electric motors that you design unless you specifically want that particular anomaly to occur when you're utilizing it. You can build your own custom electric motors or generating systems that basically are made out of mostly plastic, and the only metals that you got would be the copper wire. You don't even have to have any magnets involved in there. You can use the copper wire itself to generate the magnetic field. You can change the polarity of that magnetic field by the input of whatever you're putting inside there to have these two separate coils interacting with each other and building your own custom motors. What Sky Collection's done here is a whole lot more than your average Joe probably would have paid attention to. He literally showed the mechanics of magnetism. He showed how it worked. You got your receiving coil on this side, and if you turn it straight up and down to where the magnetic flux lines aren't passing through the majority of that wire, that you don't have enough power to run that light. But when you adjust this coil around where you know for a fact where the magnetic flux lines are expanding and collapsing, and as that magnetic field is going out, it's energizing all a whole bunch of the different turns on the next coil, and as it's collapsing, it's doing the same. Now you have a way to transfer that energy to the lighting system that he uses in his videos. It's pretty impressive. And there's so much that you can actually learn just by watching these experiments that he does and other people do in the way that they design their and engineer their coils. I also explained how he showed under when he put the pulsing coil underneath the rotor, then you would see lens effect actually taking effect. When you see him take it and put it to where he was actually energizing the rotor with it from off to the side, then you could see how the actual lens effect was actually, at the very least, reduced. And to my deal, become almost non-existent. And taking that design that he's got right there, and expanding on that design, you should be able to build an electric motor that would get such ridiculous RPMs that centrifugal force would probably take over and it would destroy itself. Because if you listen to that sound and of the video, as those RPMs are continuously rising, there's got to come some point where unless that thing is so mechanically sturdy that it would literally, you know, want to tear itself apart. It was pretty impressive what he did. And that's why I shared that video with you. So, let's see. Did I get everything on there? He also showed the, eddy currents on there. And there is another force there that, where you're actually... And they do, they have motors out there that don't have magnets in it. They use a coil system to basically induce a current that will turn an aluminum rotor. And the aluminum rotor actually has grooves cut in it that basically make and break that connection and cause that rotor to turn yet even faster. So if you understand how these motors actually function, then you understand that if worst case scenario and you had to build your own generator, you use that magnetic field as the equivalence of a cog in the machine, a gear. And you know where the best place to put your doggone receiving coils to pick up that energy that you're producing through there. And so take all this thing that we talk about today, and you literally have before you the opportunity to take everything that nature provides already and produce more energy than you're ever going to need, no matter what. The gasoline generators that aren't right now, the way you run them aren't going to run your house. If you rethink on how you actually use that energy that's coming out of there, I'm telling you, you could take a 2,500 watt generator and you could do everything that it is that you do in your house right now using nothing more than a 2,500 watt generator. Most house, if you actually look at their light bill, they're up in the kilowatt range of what they use all day long. And whatever they use per hour, I ain't seen a house yet that you can run under a 10K generator. 10,000 volt or 10,000 watt generator or higher is what it would require to run all of the appliances that are in your house. If you run them the traditional way, you're going to need that type of generator or higher in order to do it. But with a few modifications on how you're actually getting the work done, then you can reduce how much voltage you actually have to have, how much current you actually have to have, and the amount of wattage necessary to get the work done. That includes running your washing machine, or your dryer, or your hot water heater, or your television sets, or your refrigerators, or your freezers. Anything that you use in your house right now could be modified to the extent where it would be so much more efficient than what it is right now. And knowing what waste products are actually coming off of your appliances, such as the refrigerator, when you're trying to cool your house down with your air conditioner and you have your refrigerator in the kitchen and that heat transfer that is what keeps your refrigerator cool is actually being transferred out of that grill on the back of your refrigerator, your air conditioner has to be able to compensate now for that waste amount of heat that's coming off of there. So some sort of simple modification, such as putting this refrigerator into a cubbyhole space and inventing this heat off into some other direction besides the room that you're trying to cool, will make the air conditioner not have to work as hard. All of these things, even the computers that you use in your room, are generating waste energy. If you take these computers, instead of venting them into your room, your air conditioner doesn't have to work as hard because it's not trying to compensate for that extra heat being generated in your room. During the winter time, if you want, you can use these same things that's going on to help to make it to where your heating system doesn't have to work as hard, because as long as these computers are on, the resistance that's going through the cores are normally being transferred out through the heat sink, but they're now basically helping to heat your room. Tungsten element light bulbs, which are terrible as far as a resistive load, same thing. Take your thermometer, your laser thermometer, and measure how much waste heat is coming off of that light bulb. If you're trying to run your tungsten element light bulb the same time you're trying to cool your house with your air conditioner, then you have that light bulb to compete with as far as taking that heat out and moving it where you want it, as opposed to where it is right now. So essentially what we're talking here is not only the mechanics of magnetism and electricity, but efficiency. If you know the basics of science, heat rises and cold air falls, then you know how to make your house so incredibly efficient that you're barely having to pay an electric bill if you're on the power grid. And if necessary, if the power grid went down, you could take the generator that you do have access to, or even produce a generator that would utilize different types of energy, such as high frequency, high voltage. A 20,000 volt Beckett oil burner igniter produces waste heat. It also produces a high frequency that you could not run any appliance on. However, that frequency will literally run a tungsten element light bulb that is burned in half, because the frequency is able to literally jump across from one part of the broken tungsten element to the other and still energize it enough to get it hot to run that light bulb. And so even the light bulbs that are burned out would work. the energy that is produced by the high voltage is also producing heat. So if you utilize this heat energy, which is easy to get from high frequency, high voltage, that's why we don't use high voltage, because basically at certain frequencies it will literally burn through the insulation and set fire to your house. But you're not going to use it like that. You're going to use it to generate heat that you need, whether it be to energize any of the noble gases into the fourth state of matter, being plasma, which is basically heat and light at the same time. And then, like Raymond and I were talking about earlier, you can take that light, if you can get that plasma up to the white stage of visible light, you can pipe that through fiber optics into every single room of your house and have one light source for the entire house. It's not science fiction, it's science fact. It's actual physics being utilized to your advantage as opposed to your disadvantage, is the reason why we're always seeing people in the alternative energy community trying like heck to defy the laws of physics as far as Lenz's law and whatever forces of magnetism. And they usually end up failing because they overlook something. All we're literally doing is guiding energy where we want it. But at this stage in the game, we are doing it so inefficiently that we're giving people the opportunity to holler about carbon footprint. Which shouldn't even be an issue, because if you ran an internal combustion engine that was properly engineered, there wouldn't be no waste material. And that engine would be completely focused. It would be a focused heat engine, essentially. You would only have heat where you needed it, when you needed it, to get the reaction that you wanted, that is pushing the piston down and causing the torque and the amount of RPMs necessary to go as fast as you want. So, properly engineered, in the right shop, you could build the perfect engine that would not have any byproducts such as carbon emissions. You could build a custom design, any internal combustion engine to literally run off of whatever type of fuel that you specifically engineer it for. No matter what material it is, you break it down in the right manner, you can ignite it. You can get combustion. Otherwise, people's houses wouldn't catch on fire, period. Everything is flammable. It's all carbon-based. And so if you break it down right, and you send it into the combustion chamber right, any fuel will burn. Proof of concept is what we said earlier about how they used to use wood gasifiers to run old military vehicles when they were running short on fuel. So, there you go, folks. The ideas are out there for you. The website's put in place for you. Place for you to talk and get together and discuss different ideas and designs. Share links. Share everything you need, all the different ideas out there. But these ideas and this website and this radio show is only ever going to be as good as the people willing to use the information presented to them and to share this information to others. Right now, we have every single piece of the puzzle necessary to resolve every single issue under the sun. When people are ready, we'll get it done. It's going to take a combined effort of so many of the average Joes in the world with skill sets of every different thing, from chemistry to mechanics to whatever. But when it's time, when the great disaster happens and you get your best of the best together in your communities, you'll resolve the problems, and you'll find out that you probably could have resolved them a whole heck of a lot sooner. And a lot of the things that would have occurred wouldn't have been necessary. You still got wars over resources, wars over oil, and so on and so forth. The world said they need a clean, renewable, alternative energy, and here's the solution. And it's free. Energy is free. No ifs, ands, or buts. No, as they say in the liberal world, the debate is over. They said the whole climate change debate was over. The free energy debate is over. If you can't find free energy, you are simply not looking hard enough, or you're trying to suppress the information and the knowledge for everyone else out there. The sun has never sent you a bill. The wind has never sent you a bill. The water has never sent you a bill. The earth has never sent you a bill. If you use all the forces of nature, and you use a little bit of basic science and some common sense, and you make your equipment run so clean and efficient, there is no issue for the climate change people to holler about. There is no way that people would have a justification to go into war over resources. And things would last a whole heck of a lot longer than they do now. It's that simple. So as far as I'm concerned, I've already proven my case that energy is free. Now I'm going to take all this information that I've compiled throughout all the time that I've been doing the Mad Science Show and my YouTube channel, and I'm going to put it into play into a nifty gizmo. And when I think enough people paying attention, I'm going to lay it down on the table. And I'm going to walk away. That's what I'm here to do. So with that said, peace and love, everybody. You've been listening to the Mad Science Show.
Never mind that.
Why, that's me. Look at me. I'm an old man.
Hey, I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing here on the parking lot.
Thank God I still got my hair. What on earth is this thing I'm wearing?
Wow, this is a radiation suit.
Radiation suit? Of course. Because of all the fallout from the atomic wars. This is truly amazing. A portable television studio. No wonder your president has to be an actor. He's got to look good on television.
Whoa, this is it. This is the part coming up, Doc.
No. This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
What did I just say?
Flux capacitor stores... This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Great Scott! What the hell is a gigawatt? How could I have been so careless? 1.21 gigawatts! Tom, how am I going to generate that kind of power? It can't be done, can it?
Look, all we need is a little plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium is available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by. Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're stuck here.
Whoa, Doc, stuck here? I can't be stuck here. I got a wife in 1985. I got a girl.
Is she pretty?
Oh, she's beautiful. She's crazy about me. Look at this. Look what you wrote here, Doc. I mean... That says it all. Doc, my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, it just might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
Thank you.
crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.